Cannon, Andrew Pettiprin. Now, this is a new book, brand new, really. We will be probably one of the very first groups, actually, reading this book and discussing it together. It was just published last month. And so we are kind of in a little bit of a unique position as far as exploring this book together before many others have had the chance to do so. I suggested this book only because I knew about it through a personal connection. I am quite happy to say that, again, this is the first time I have been personally acknowledged in a public work, and there are the acknowledgments.
I saw it underlined.
That's right. That's right. David Peoples, Jonathan French, the God Squad. So, to give you a little bit of personal background of how I know the Reverend Canon Andrew Pettiprin, he was hired several years ago to be the rector of my home church in Orlando. They had just had kind of a tempestuous relationship with their last rector, who it ended poorly. And the church I grew up in, I only knew one rector. So Father Risner, and that's, outside of the church, people always knew him as Bob. I couldn't fathom ever calling him Bob, but he was Father Risner. And he was my example of the priesthood and of being a rector and of the Episcopal Church and everything else. He started shortly before I was born, and he retired basically when I was finishing college. He was one of those old school Episcopal priests that not just wore the clerical collar, but that was a vow and a promise on a daily basis of how he would serve. So here was a guy, we used to joke that he must wear that collar in the shower. Pretty sure there's a story of him wearing it to the beach. So what's really funny is that years later, I'm up in seminary in Swain, Tennessee, and Father Risner, who seemed like he was a million years old when I knew him, and when I say that he retired when I went to when I finished college, he actually collapsed at his own retirement party. So, I mean, this is a guy that, I mean, you just really have this feeling that as a ministry, he had given it his literal all. And he kind of looked like he was going to die. But he didn't. He retired. He retired, and he and his wife moved up to the area around Sevierville, Tennessee, which is, it's around Knoxville. Mm-hmm. And so up in seminary, my parents had come to visit me, and we decided we were going to make arrangements to go up and visit. We hadn't seen them in several years, but we kind of kept in touch a little bit. So it had been, years since we had seen them, 8-9 years maybe. And so we drove up to meet them, and they had this beautiful cabin in the woods. And he was wearing a cardigan sweater. No collar. It was just the craziest thing to see this guy without a collar. He was wearing a sweater like Mr. Rogers.
Okay.
And okay. He looked younger then than when he had retired. So had he given so much in his ministry and to Christ and to the church? I think probably, and then getting away from that and rest and recover. So anyway, that was my model. That was the life of that church. And then the next two rectors did not follow that model. And there were, plenty of issues. But it was more of when Andrew was hired, my number one concern was a pastor who would be kind. It was a church that I loved very much. They were family. That's how I grew up. I grew up with thinking this is my extended family, and I wanted someone who would care for them. And you know, preaching and teaching and all that other sort of stuff, while not unimportant, seemed to pale in comparison after having several years and 2 tenures where the kindness seemed to be missing. So Andrew was young, younger than me, which at the time was kind of a trick because there weren't that many. This was several years ago. And he had been an assistant for a couple of years out of state, but it turns out he had grown up in the area. He had actually grown up and gone to the big Methodist church not far from my home church, and had gone to school at that private school with some of the kids I grew up with in my church. So there were all sorts of connections, even to the point where it turns out that his mother and my mother went to high school together. So I didn't know much about him early on, but not that long after he arrived, you know, within the first few months probably, my grandfather died. And so my first real connection with Andrew was around the bedside of my grandfather with hospice. And he was magnificent. He was pastoral and caring. He not only gave a darn, but he did so in a way that was evident and obvious. And he sat with the family and he loved my grandparents. And even though he had only known them for a space of months, he had gotten to know them because he had cared. And now, in the end, he was going to care for them faithfully and well. And I remember walking away and calling a couple of my friends who were, you know, colleagues in the diocese and saying, you know, I'm on the Andrew train, that this guy is doing some good things, and I am grateful that he is going to care for my family. So over the years, Andrew and I developed a close friendship, and he did a very faithful and loving job to my parish family. He buried both of my grandparents and my dad as well. It was an honor for me to be able to preach at my dad's funeral as Andrew celebrated, and us to basically do it together. About a year and a half ago, Andrew's been a writer. He's very intellectual. And the course of his writings, he had started writing both in an online and a printed journal, had attracted the attention of Bishop Bauer Schmidt in the Diocese of Tennessee, who had started speaking to Andrew about a year and a half ago, hired Andrew to become the new canon to the ordinary in the Diocese of Tennessee. So that was a sad day for all of us, but, you know, wanted to be happy on his account that he was being entrusted with this high responsibility. To be the canon to the ordinary means you are the bishop's right-hand man. The ordinary means the bishop who does the ordaining, meaning if you have more than one bishop, it's the top bishop, and you are his canon, you are his servant, basically. So you kind of become by default sort of the chief administrator of the diocese, typically. You have to kind of keep track of things, whether it's congregational development issues, whether it's deployment and employment issues for various clergy, you know, different things that the bishop wants to accomplish. You are kind of the top of the team in helping to accomplish those goals. And so though he was young at the time, you know, still in his mid-30s, and I mean, now in his mid-30s, or I guess he's getting towards his late 30s now. And with a, you know, relatively brief tenure, he was at St. Mary's, I would say, for maybe 6 years or so, and he'd have been assistant for a couple years before that. So this was quite a statement to be entrusted with this kind of position. And it really demonstrated and pointed to the sort of guy, the sort of pastor, the sort of gifts that he was bringing to the church. So this book then is sort of an outworking of several things he had been thinking through his last couple of years in the parish here in our diocese, and then it was finished and finalized within his first several months working in the Diocese of Tennessee and living in Nashville with his family, and it's now been published. So one of the things that I would like us to be able to do, perhaps when we get a little deeper in, is, and I've spoken to him about this, and I am going to arrange a video conference of our group speaking with the author. And he can answer questions, he can talk to us about stuff, whatever it is. This may be the only chance we ever have as a book group for us to actually interact with the author, and he is happy to do that. So as we work through this, I think we will find in this wise words and concepts worth considering. But I want to emphasize my personal knowledge of this author is such that I can say with confidence that he is a good man and a good priest. Not just skilled, not just knowledgeable, not just sharp and erudite, but I mean he is good in all of the right and proper facets. He is wholesome and honest. He is faithful and kind. He is gracious and loves the Lord, and I believe we'll see that on basically every page. There are some people whose life and ministry has allowed others to kind of trust them as they, you know, read through them together. You know, when you read a book, you're kind of putting your heart in the hands of another. You know, I remember reading a couple of books where I got mad at the end because I felt like I was tricked. Like, I trusted you! You turned on me at the end! You! And so there's some authors who, because of their body of work or because of their life, we kind of can read them and have our guard down because we know they're trustworthy. Well, Andrew doesn't have, you know, decades of writing and a worldwide audience to vouch for him, but I personally don't trust anyone more than him, and I think this will be a good book for us all. So that's my introduction to this book. And let's look at chapter 1. I believe in God. Okay, so he actually starts in kind of an interesting place, but I think it's a telling place. And I think it's a telling place generationally. So he starts with what event?
9/11.
Right. So everything changes in 2001. And he starts off, not just the chapter, but the book, with 9/11 and some of the aftermath, the practical aftermath about trying to fly and the heightened levels of security and anxiety, but also just the sort of mental weight carried at this particular time. Now, almost every generation has a moment or moments that they remember very, very well. Some kind of formative experience, oftentimes tragic or terrible, where, you know, everyone around that age, when somebody starts talking about it, they all start, yep, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then they start sharing stories because they remember something about that, you know, about, you know, where you were or what was going on. So, moving deeper than 9/11, what might it be for some of you? What was a momentous event that you think people around your age would all say, oh yes, I remember where I was when I heard such and such?
Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. When Kennedy was shot.
Kennedy?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it reminded me of when I read this.
Yeah.
First part of it.
Right, and I think, you know, Again, depending on the generation. And it tends to be something when you're relatively young, but old enough to understand. There's probably maybe a generational sweet spot where it just sort of affects you in a very formative way. You know, like talking to my parents, they would say something like Kennedy would probably be number one. But there were some other ones that were very important to them. The moon landing they remember. They remember crowding around a TV. My dad remembers hearing when Elvis died. I mean, it's stuff like that. For me, you know, 9/11 was enormously influential, but my generation already had one, in the sense that if you are roughly my age, plus or minus, there is an event that you remember, especially if you are a Floridian, that you remember that was formative, and that's the Challenger. We all remember. We all remember, especially Floridians, because that was still when shuttle launches might get an assembly outside to watch it. And this one in particular was important to school children because Krista McAuliffe was a teacher. And it was this big deal that we are sending up an elementary school teacher, an educator. And so I remember I was in the sixth grade and it was a cold day. It's cold and dry. And I remember being outside. I remember there being this awkward, anxious pause. I remember the principal coming on the all-school intercom telling teachers to take all of their children inside. I remember another awkward, anxious pause, and then the principal coming back on telling the teachers to turn on the TV. And in a variety of ways, and how that played out within our childhood psyches over the months. But again, you get someone kind of that Generation X sort of cohort, and especially if they were a Floridian, but potentially other, you know, across the country. But you ask them to think of a formative moment prior to 9/11, and don't be surprised if they say the Challenger. So for the millennials, the millennials are too young, but for basically the people who have come after us, 9/11 was an event that kind of magnified that across generations. You didn't have to be in a specific group for 9/11 to really capture your imagination in all the wrong ways. Old and young alike, we were all deeply impacted. You remember where you were?
Yes. I was at Wine and Roses, and we were glued to the radio. There was nothing done that morning. We all like listening. It was crazy.
Yeah.
Then my kitchen had a very small TV, and I had been doing dishes and turned around and saw the plane go into the building.
I was walking in the church that morning, and the church secretary told me about it.
We're listening, and we heard when the other plane just was. And my plane!
I just sent my children off to school. I turned the television on, and the first one had already hit. And as I was standing there, the second one hit, and it was like, this is a movie.
Yes.
It's unbelievable.
Yes.
Right. Exactly.
I was driving. I was driving to church, driving to work. This was my first job out of seminary, and I was an assistant. And it was in the morning. And I usually have the radio on. And I was driving, and I was pretty close to church. And I was listening on the radio, and they interrupted the broadcast to talk about this plane crash.
Yeah.
And it was the first one. Mm-hmm. And so they were still talking about, we don't know what's happened, and there was an air of, you know, that this was an accident. Everything was being talked about, and it was like for not a long period of time, but for a couple of minutes. But about, this was very serious, but it was like a plane going down anywhere. But it happened in such a terrible place. And then while they were talking, the second one went in,
yes.
And you could just hear it over the radio, where people started just panicking that this was on purpose.
Yeah.
And so suddenly, and I pulled off the side of the road. And so suddenly, I'm thinking, what now?
Yeah.
You know, all sorts of stuff raced through your mind, and I called Lula. We, you know, had a cell phone and. Stay where you are. You know, had you taken our daughter to preschool yet? Don't go. Stay home. Wanting to make sure that people were safe, not knowing if this was an isolated incident or if it was going to start happening everywhere. Thinking, well, we're not all that far from MacDill Air Force Base. What if there's some kind of coordinated, who knows what's going on? You know, in the Being a kid who grew up in the 80s, you know, we remember watching the day after and Red Dawn, and the Russians might, you know, bomb us and we're gonna duck and cover when the ICBMs come, whatever. So this was a horribly momentous moment. And it's one that obviously changed things dramatically for some time.
Yeah.
And there are some effects which are present with us even now.
Yeah.
I have a great-grandson that was born on September 11th. And their immediate reaction was, oh, well, we won't forget his birthday.
No. And we may know people who were more directly impacted, mm-hmm. people who were living in the city, some who were potentially working in the tower, maybe even people who died. I had a parishioner at my last parish who was working at the Pentagon at the time. He was not injured because you forget just how incredibly gigantic the Pentagon is. And you can, you know, have destruction at one corner of the Pentagon and it's like a quarter mile away from everybody else. But still, I mean, he had coworkers and friends who were killed. And so this has changed everything. And Andrew starts this off with there was a moment of disconnection from everything that we thought we knew. You know, that bad things can happen, but not this. Anybody have to fly within the months after 9/11? I did. It wasn't immediately after. It was you know, like 3 months after. But it was eerie and quiet. There were very few people. And there were armed soldiers, not just guard. I mean, there were soldiers. They were in fatigues. And they were all carrying weapons openly. And I had seen that before. But in third world countries. I had never seen that in Orlando.
Yeah.
And that's what goes through your mind when you go to the airport, too. This is like a third world country. We never expected to see this in our country.
Yeah. I will say, though, that there was something almost equally profound that happened that where people started identifying with 9/12, with that sense of unity, that suddenly political differences and racial differences and personal differences, there was a period of time where everything just kind of fell away. And there was very little doubt that we were in this together. There is, for my money, the first Spider-Man movie, the Sam Raimi directed Tobey Maguire movie that came out in 2001, it's like the best one, it's my favorite. And I remember seeing it And I was a Spider-Man fan reading the comics growing up as a kid. And so I was amazed by it, because this is way before superheroes were getting a lot of TV movies. This was the first one that felt so well done. And I remember watching it, and I was an overwhelming sense of gratitude that I never thought I would actually see my hero up on the screen in such a way that I could really love and enjoy. And there's a part where Spider-Man is tried to save his girlfriend, and he's dangling off a bridge, and the Green Goblin, who's the villain, swings back around, and he is going to throw a bomb at him and you know, knock him off and kill him. And all of a sudden, right before he can do that, the Green Goblin is hit by something that somebody else throws at him. And there's a whole mass of New Yorkers who have now gathered on the bridge, throwing stuff at the Green Goblin, and one of them points at him and says, "You mess with one of us, you mess with all of us." And I get chills every time I see that, because the director and the writer put that in on purpose. They weren't going to identify 9/11 in a specific manner to date the movie forever, but there was this sense of, we are in this together. And that sentiment, especially these days, feels sorely lacking.
Oh, yeah.
We had people coming out to church for the first time in many years, people who were searching for meaning and for hope for the first time in many years.
People prayed, well, I've never prayed before.
but just a realization that there were big questions that the day-to-day of our lives had been sort of covering over, if not smothering. And when the towers fell, it's like it cleared all that stuff off. And it exposed those big lasting questions that had always been underneath, but for the most part, so many folks had just kind of gone about their day-to-day lives and never paid attention to. Now everybody's asking big questions, and everybody's wondering, you know, big thoughts. And it was not just a national crisis. For a lot of people, it was a very personal, very spiritual crisis. You started thinking about, you know, no one could fly in a plane for quite some time without the thought, what would I do if? And lots of people are not good flyers. You know, you get nervous when you fly or whatever. And you go, oh, this, you know, this plane might crash. But in a very, very concrete way, for a period of time after that, every flight had this kind of gravitas, like suddenly this was important. And it's not just that planes could potentially crash at this, you know, very low percentage. Oh, it's more dangerous to drive a car than it is to fly in a plane. But it just sort of seemed like the brake lines in our cars had been cut. And life itself was a little more dangerous, and simple things were kind of up for grabs. Very disconcerting.
Yep.
So when we are buffeted by wind and wave, what do we want to do more than anything else other than grab onto something solid? So what was going on in Andrew's life as he's writing these first couple of pages? Because we've got a lot of coincidental of life events here. We're dealing with 9/11, and what is he dealing with?
His spiritual life.
His spiritual life. It's gone very dry.
Yeah.
Raised in the church, raised with faith, but again, Andrew's a very bright guy, and
now he's wondering if, is it just this? Mm. What next? Is there something else?
The intellectual life has its own temptations.
Yeah.
And they're very easy to slip into. thinking that what you learned as a child must, by definition, be childish, mm-hmm. and therefore not no longer important or true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you have learned more, because your brain and your thought processes have matured, that those beliefs and thoughts as you were younger, well, it's time to put that away.
Don't you hang on to them in the background, though?
Maybe you do. Maybe you do. But the temptation is to put them as far back in the background as possible, where it's in a practical sense like tossing them out, you know, that you wouldn't put a loose tooth under a pillow hoping for a quarter anymore, that you would say all of these things were just a part of childhood, and now I know better because I'm smarter, I'm older, I'm more mature, I'm better educated, whatever it might be.
I used to wonder about that when I was in college, and the professors and so many of them were not believers, or at least didn't preach that they were believers at that time. And I kept thinking to myself, how could someone be so educated and they can't believe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I began to understand, as you do educate yourself, there is that danger.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, it's very easy to mix and match, to conflate the simple with the simplistic. You know, Andrew's talking about rejecting a God at our beck and call, a God who fits our agenda,
mm-hmm.
who fits his preconceived notions or his childlike faith, and rejecting that because, you know, as life matures and we see the complexities and the difficulties and the suffering and everything else, that God as Santa Claus or God as a genie or God as someone who is just sort of there for us only as we want and need him is discarded. It's simplistic. It's overly uncomplicated to the point of being wrong. The problem is that there is such a thing as simplicity, as being simple, that's still true, and it's right. As a matter of fact, simplicity as a philosophical or a mathematical term starts pointing to the almost really the perfection of truth and how uncomplicated and easy it is to reach. The simplest answer then to solving an equation or a mathematical function is the one that takes the fewest amount of steps to get to the right answer. It's related to elegance, to mathematical and philosophical elegance in that manner, where the beauty is in the minimal amount of extra to achieve your goal or to achieve your effect. So a truth can be simple and completely accurate and true. You can toss it out by saying it's not just simple, it's simplistic, meaning it's dumb and wrong, but you might be the dumb and wrong one. Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. Little ones to him belong, they are weak, but he is strong. Yes, Jesus loves me, for the Bible tells me so. Simple. Now, you can say, well, it's simplistic, it's a child song, it doesn't, you know, fully capture the nuance and the detail of real life, but it actually does. You know, Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. At the end of the day, it's almost as short and brief, but as accurate as you can get. Sometimes the true art is knowing when the painting is done, and it doesn't need anything else. And any extra stroke will actually take away rather than add to it. That's simplicity. That's elegance. The truth is the truth, and anything else on top of it doesn't actually help it. It actually kind of detracts a little bit.
It's true.
So Andrew or any of us wanting to discard a simplistic childish faith by saying, well, it's just no, it's not true. It was, I only believed it because I didn't know any better, but now I do, can throw the baby out with the bathwater. You don't have to believe in a cartoon God who has a white robe and a white beard and sits on a throne on a cloud to still believe in God the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth. Elements of it may indeed be simplistic and therefore wrong. But a faith which is simple, even a faith which is childlike, is not necessarily wrong at all. And some of the most important and profound truths are the simplest. What helps Andrew rediscover this?
Nicene Creed.
The Nicene Creed, but even before that, he's pointed back to faith and back to the church from a very unexpected source. He goes to England. He's growing up and through college and everything else, and these first things that start reigniting his mind and his heart are more academic.
He mentioned T.S. Eliot.
And C.S. Lewis.
C.S. Lewis. So poetry and philosophy, drama, intellectual pursuits, he starts seeing in the history of mankind's greatest achievements how many of the most expressive of the arts, the paintings, the sculptures, the writings, the stories, the poems, were done very explicitly and purposefully for the glory of God. It's really hard to dismiss faith as something for small children or dumb people when the greatest of human minds are working at their absolute best in order to glorify that same God. And that's one of those things that can start kind of making a difference. There is a very interesting phrase attributed to the German composer Richard Wagner. And Wagner was a bad guy in a lot of respects, but he was also a guy who seemed to be searching for meaning and truth and finding some truth within Scripture and Christ himself. And he made a comment about that great art is, it's by definition going to be religious. Truly great art points our hearts and our minds to the transcendent. It's invariably an act of worship, whether you realize it or not. A great art that can be on a sort of a secular theme, but to see the pinnacle of human achievement, of creativity, and of beauty, beauty points us to the truth of God. Only through God could something like that be achieved. And it was actually stuff like that that wound up destroying the relationship between Wagner and Nietzsche, the atheist philosopher. Because Nietzsche loved Wagner's music, but he started hating what Wagner was saying about great music being intrinsically religious, because he was so anti-religious that, I don't want to think about art pointing me to a source of beauty and goodness and truth.
Sounds like the discussions this morning.
So we get some work, especially from T.S. Eliot. A couple of things from T.S. Eliot. What does he read in particular?
Wasteland.
Mm-hmm. Wasteland written in kind of view of World War I. If you know much about World War One, what did they call it at the time? They didn't call it World War One at the time, because you don't number something if you think it's the only one.
The Great War.
Because this is the greatest, the largest in scale and scope of anyone they ever seen. Aha! What's the other thing they sometimes called it? They called it the war to end all wars. No one had seen destruction and death on such an enormous and an industrial scale. This is the first, not only crossing almost every border, but with the mechanized efficiency of killing that you've never seen before. And you know, we've got poison gases, we've got tanks, we've got aircraft, we've got gigantic cannons that are able to cause destruction from miles and miles away, and none of that had happened before, and it certainly never happened on such a consuming scale. And they start calling it the war to end all wars, because certainly after this much destruction, it could never get any worse. So, yeah. It did.
It did. God help us when the next one comes.
So, to be able to be able to live through World War One and see that this did not solve our problem. Wars still happen, and death and destruction still occur. There was no peace treaty, there was no leader, there was no victory that was going to set things right for good. If you saw the Wonder Woman movie from a couple of years ago, it was a period piece set during World War One, which was real fun because you don't see a lot of movies set in World War One anymore. And Wonder Woman was fighting who she believed to be Ares, the god of war, who was really the ultimate author behind World War One. And the thought was, if I can defeat Ares personally, then all of this worldwide madness will stop. Well, in the climax of the movie, she does. She beats him. But people keep fighting. There was no goal that could be achieved that was going to change the human heart. So, we still fight, there are still wars, there are still suffering, there are still loss. Terrible things happen, tragic things happen. There are still wind and wave that threaten us. What can we hold on to that is solid and sure? And they're kind of feeling maybe the spirits of Eliot and C.S. Lewis. Andrew is coming back to the Creed. The Creed of the early church. The faith of the apostles, in a place where, well, that's a great line about to kneel where prayer has been valid. England these days is pretty dang secular, way more than we are. But there are these little places left of beauty and hope and truth. And I just have to wonder what it must feel like to be there and to know that some of the greats of the faith, some of the saints of old, have sat right where you were or kneeled right where you were, have touched what you touched, and they were praying just like you can pray right now. So there is something solid to hold on to. It's expressed through the creeds. What does he say about the way that the creed is written in the fashion that he has presented in the book? He has it basically out of the prayer book, and it's sort of formatted in a particular way. Not just with what it says, but even the line breaks. What is it for?
It says to be recited aloud.
That's right. That's right. So when we're reading something to ourselves, we can just kind of scan right across a paragraph. But when you say something out loud, you want some natural breaks so that your eye can communicate to your brain, can communicate to your voice when to go up, when to go down, and when to stop. All the more when you've got multiple people trying to say the same thing at the same time. It's like music. There's a meter to it. And you can kind of know. Da-da-da-da-da-da-dum. Da-da-da-da-da-da-dum. It's like poetry. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. That we can stand and say this together. I believe in God the Father Almighty. So Andrew writes this really for the hope of Christians everywhere, that there can be a lot of things that make us feel very different from each other and keep us apart. Musical styles and churchmanship and the way that we interpret different things or what have you. But if there's a 9-12 moment, if there's a time where the hard realities of life bring people together because all of the stuff on top has been swept away and the big true things underneath have been exposed, then maybe it's in something like the Apostles' Creed. Simple. Simple. It's not simplistic, but it's simple. Just giving the basics. The faith that those who are with Jesus himself taught, that Scripture points to and the church affirms. All right, how we doing?
Okay.
Any other questions?
I like on page 7 at the bottom where we said truth matters to him because he loves God.
Yeah.
It's really
very simple.
So he's going to do everything.
And it should matter to everyone who loves God.
Yeah.
He is the God of truth, and all truth is God's truth. And what is the great commandment? To love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And so, a truth that our minds can wrestle with, that our hearts can hope in, and our strength can stand on. And that's not bad. Okay.